The Office of the State Historian is proud to present the New Mexico Digital History Project podcast series.
Yate, she ya Jennifer Nez Dinet Dell and she looking slow and she bashes chin. Kilichini dash a che to a head clinic dash another. Tohach at the AIUC that Nasha do dok o sleet the Kinlanada ad a shah ultra to a conshama rose nez Makonihitra Sata to a hair bidini shama. I want to thank my mother for coming with me to Santa Fe. I just introduced you in the proper way in Navajo, and if any of you are Oki clan, then you are related to me on my mother's side, and if you're Salt clan, you're related to me on my father's side. So that's how we still recognize ourselves as Navajos. I want to share with you a larger some of the things that I've been working on as a historian, Diné historian. And I want to start with just talking about some of my inspiration for research. It's a multi kind of dimensional, many places that I find inspiration for my research. And the first book that I wrote, published, it took me like 10 to 15 years. It took me forever, the Reclaiming Diné History. And it started as a dissertation, and then it took me a long time to turn it into a book. And what took me so long was really thinking about and reconceptualizing and thinking seriously about what the past means and how the past has been presented through Western concepts of history. And do Navajos think about the past differently? And if we think about it differently, then what does the past look like? And so those were really difficult questions for me to answer. And being probably the third generation of Native historians, my generation of Native historians have really moved away from American historiography. I think the first generation were trained in American historiography and what they call New Indian History. And I think there's a whole bunch of us who are moving away from that and really looking at doing a historiography that takes inspiration from Native studies by Native historians, taking a global view, and really looking at how colonialism has structured who we are as Native peoples, as Diné people, how it structures and shapes our communities, and how it shapes our respective Indian nations. And so that's kind of the inspires my work. I consider my work to be for Navajo people and for Native people. And my questions, the kinds of things that I think about, topics, I consider it to be community-based research, and it really is generated by just talking to people from my community, from just by other Native scholars as well. Last week I was in Window Rock and looking in the Navajo land claims papers. These are the 1958, 1959 was really one of the first really large efforts of data collection on Navajo people. We hired all these white researchers, anthropologists, archaeologists, historians, and they collected this incredibly massive data that's, some of it's in Window Rock and some of it's just gone, you know, it just disappeared. But in looking at this collection, this incredible amount of information that was compiled, it really makes me think about how the land claims that a lot of Indian tribes went through, how that collection really worked to shape Native national identities. You know? So I've been thinking a lot about that. When I was in Window Rock last week, I could hardly get some work done because I was too busy talking to people. There was a young Navajo man who was exhibiting Navajo hats, men's hats, those traditional hats, and he had all different kinds of hats out there, some made from beaver skin, buck skin, mountain lion skin, all shapes, different kinds of feathers. And I said, "Are these, how historically accurate are these caps?" So we started talking about men's caps, and he was telling me that you could tell the cap, the way it looked, the characteristics of the cap. He said you could tell where a man came from, what clan he was from, and what place he came from. And he said there were hats for peace, and there were wartime hats. You know, so we had a really good conversation. And then I went and talked to another man who worked there at the museum, and he was a curator, and we started talking about photographs. And then we sat down and had an hour-long discussion, and he was telling me about the roots of the Navajo-Hopi land dispute, and that if those people in communities like Pinon ever get a hold of Peter McDonald, you know. so you get a lot of information, and you get a lot of ideas of for topics. And so I consider all those places to be the basis for the kind of work that I do. And so when I talk to my students about my work and what's important and what the purpose is and what is the vision for the work that we do and the scholarship that we do, I tell my students to imagine this. I tell them that at one time, the Diné were an autonomous people. We had in place a political system, an economic system, a social system, and a ceremonial system that served us really well. You know, we were very much an independent people. And just recently, I got through most of this book. It's a new book. Let's see who it's by. William B. Carter, and it's titled Indian Alliances and the Spanish in the Southwest, 1750 to 1750. And what he does in this book is one of the arguments he makes is that a lot of the resistance displayed by Pueblo peoples along the Rio Grande and Zuni and Hopi really was pivotal upon being able to create alliances with Navajos and Apaches, and that there was a whole continuum of relationships of alliances, marriage, intermarriage, trading, you know, at different times they would go and live with Navajo people, you know. And I think that it's really important to talk about these issues, because I think Navajos still very much have to deal with the stereotypes of being cultural borrowers, late arrivals, aggressive, nomadic. You know, those ideas are still firmly in place, and scholarship continues to reiterate those stereotypes of Navajo people. And one of the things I tell my students is that those stereotypes have political power. You know, because of those kinds of stereotypes, we are not seen as a people who have real, deep, and sacred connections to the land. You know? And so those have had a lot of repercussions for Navajo people. And so that's one of the reasons why what we do as scholars is important. So I have a lot of questions always about how the representations of the past shape our identity as individual Diné, as community members, and how it shapes our nation. And that the ways in which we have been represented by non-Indians has a significant impact on us, and still has a significant impact on us. My work then interrogates those spaces that have been shaped by history of colonialism. And there are many Native scholars now who are mapping the shifting relationships between tribal nations and the U.S. Government in order to illuminate the history of Native sovereigns and the erosion of tribal sovereignties under federal Indian policies, and especially by the U.S. Supreme Court. I think it was 2 weeks ago, I had the opportunity to go to the Native American and Native and Indigenous Scholars Association conference. It's a brand new conference, and this is its third year. And there were over 600 scholars, most of them Indigenous, there to share their work, and so we had an opportunity to hear and talk with Maori scholars, Indigenous Australian scholars, scholars from First Nation, and I have to tell you that those Mohawks are kicking some butt. And not only are the Mohawk scholars kicking butt, but the women, the Native women scholars, are really forging new scholarship, and it's just so it's a really fascinating and wonderful time to be doing this kind of work. And being at that conference, I got a chance to hear the Mohawk scholar Tiaki Alfred and have breakfast with him. And you know, the man is just incredible. I mean, he could be reading a laundry list, and I'd just go, "Oh, that's just wonderful." You know, could you go back to start from item three again? You know, just because he's just compelling, but his vision is just amazing in terms of decolonization. And he's at the University of British Columbia. He's got some great books out. If you Google him, you'll find his work. You know, but his work is an inspiration to Native communities and nations and scholars like myself. So Tiaki Alfred argues that Native peoples must return to a governance based on traditional principles. Other scholars insist that we might look to constitutions and treaties which were established and created as a result of Indian-white relations in the formation of the American nation as tools to reassert sovereignty and to remind the U.S. of its obligation to Native peoples. These intellectual discussions about Native sovereignty are part of discussions about the need to decolonize our respective communities and nations. And another scholar who I just am inspired by her vision is the Dakota historian Wazia Watawan. And you can find work on Dakota history by Wazia Watawan, which is also visionary. Her colonized name is Angela Cavender Wilson, so some of the work she does is also under the name Angela Cavender Wilson. Wazia Watawan has articulated the goals of Native scholars' intellectual labors. She says that it is part of our responsibility, a major part of our responsibility, to work for the decolonization of our people, our communities, and our nations. And she defines decolonization as, decolonization means the fomenting of a critical understanding of the colonial structures that have shaped Indigenous lives and communities, and bringing back to our community useful ways of talking about our experiences and co-creating a culture of resistance based on both the recovery of Indigenous knowledge and the traditional means of resistance, as well as the useful theoretical frameworks and language from outside our cultures that can assist us in our struggle. Okay. So a decolonization framework allows for the interrogations of the present state of tribal governments so that we may return to traditional philosophies as the foundation of our communities and our nation. So this is one of many kinds of conversations and discussions that are going on within Navajo country, and I've been a participant in a series of panel discussions at Diné College under the retired Chief Justice Robert Yazzie, who's the director of the Diné Policy Institute, and he's him and his some young Navajo scholars, some of them are grad students, have, you know, they assembled this group of Navajos, and it's an amazing forum because at this forum you have medicine people, you have cultural resource specialists, you have directors of various Native programs, you have several of us university-trained scholars, and so it's a really incredible discussion that we have for like 8 hours. And most of the discussion happens in Navajo. And we take a discussion. He gives us an issue to talk about that's pertinent to the Navajo Nation. For example, one time we discussed gambling, you know. And they're really, and it's almost all in Navajo, and the medicine people will talk about the issue in terms and frame it within the traditional creation narratives, and then we'll talk about it. So we have, it's just wonderful discussions. I remember when we were talking about gambling at the casinos, and they were just moving into, they were moving into structure, building the casino outside of Gallup, and some of the Navajo people said, well, why are you asking us any questions about gambling? You guys have already decided that you're going to have a casino, so why bother asking us, you know? And then the medicine people gave some thought about it and talked about the creation story and the gambler, you know, who was came out of who was at Chaco Canyon. And when the medicine people got through talking about gambling, one of the traditional scholars, he teaches Navajo history at Dene College. His name is Wilson Arrowneth. just burst into tears. He got so mad at the medicine men. He says, and he called them a bunch of traitors, because he says their rendition of how gambling fits in the traditional narratives, they were pretty much sanctioning casinos, and he was so angry about it, you know, and everybody was just like really quiet. And so those are the kinds of forums that we have there. And then one time we had a forum on marriage, Navajo marriage, and the same-sex marriage ban, you know, and that was a really interesting topic, really engaging, and it was really great. So I'll talk a little bit more about that later. So then when I'm talking then about a decolonization framework, I'm talking about the interrogation of these kinds of issues that are important to Navajo people and that are important to Navajos. And one of the questions that we ask is, how do we return to a life based upon the principles of Sa'anaraibik Ehwajon? You know, how do we return to that? How does it structure our lives individually? How does it structure our society? How do we return to it based, our tribal government, based on that foundation? So these are the questions that we're having. And when I've talked about this, I remember talking about it, and there was, I think he was probably a council delegate in the audience. He raised his hand and said, well, how do we return to these principles for our government? You know, I don't have the answer. You know, there's no recipe that shows us how do we return to traditional principles, you know. But I think one of the first steps, and it's a step that we're engaging, is to talk about it and to imagine it, you know, and to think about what that government looks like. And so that's what we're doing right now, is we're having these really thoughtful and critical discussions, and I'm pleased to be part of that. So that's part of what I do with my research. So today, then, I want to share with you some of the work that I've already done and some of the work in progress that I'm doing on Dene and the Era of Progress, and explore the ways, in my work, I explore the ways in which the Navajo Nation was shaped by federal Indian policy and the assumptions about how societies developed, nations were naturalized, you know, as the pinnacle of civilization. There's this assumption that societies progress and that the way in which you move forward and the natural conclusion is to become a nation. You know? And so that kind of thought was put in place for Navajo people and other Indian people with the 1934 Indian Reorganization Act. And that has had a lot of repercussions for Navajo people, and that I'm looking at through my work. So my work complements the scholarship of other Native scholars who are using Native feminist analysis to illuminate the contours of Native nations. In what ways are Native nations modeled on Euro-American concepts of government? Does the Navajo Nation embody traditional concepts of governance? And what do we see when we apply Native feminist analysis to the study of the Navajo government? Okay, so these are some of the questions that I deal with. I want to start, when I start talking about the language of progress and the language of development, with the 1968 Navajo Centennial. And I brought a book here. This is edited by Martin Link, and it's a book titled Navajo, A Century of Progress, 1868 to 1968. And I think 1968 was a really pivotal time in Navajo history, the Navajo leaders decided that they were going to kick off a whole year-long celebration of 100 years of the Navajo people's return from Huelde, from Bosque Redondo, where they were imprisoned from 1863 to 1868. And under the chairmanship of Raymond Nakai, they then did a whole year-long celebration and talked about what does it mean? What does it mean? What has the last 100 years meant? You know, in terms of Navajo development, the kinds of strides that Navajos made. What does that mean to look back, you know, 100 years? And so there was all these events that were happening. There was the Navajo Fair. There was essay contests put out. The work, the research data that had been collected for the 1958 land claims, those same people who collected the research were also instrumental in working with Navajo leaders to describe what 1968 meant, you know, and it's really interesting because it's very much the language of development and the language of modernization, you know, looking back and telling Navajo people, look, this is how far you've progressed, you know, and the way in which we've progressed is very much reflects mainstream American cultural values, you know, this is how far you've come in 100 years. And so they also had books come out, essays come out, and this is one book that came out for the event. It's called, I showed you that, but it's really interesting because of the way it's laid out in terms of the development, the return from the Bosque Redondo, the signing of the Treaty of 1868. They did a reenactment of the signing of the Treaty of 1868. They went back to, and in Navajo traditional stories, we were told, the medicine people said that once they had left Bosque Redondo, they had left Huelde, the people were never to go back to Huelde, you know, because they had conducted the ceremony and we were to move forward, you know, we were to return back to our former residences and our former way of life, and we were never to go back. Well, in 1968, you know, our leaders and all their wisdom, I find out, are the first ones to go back to Huelde. You know, so now when you hear people don't want to go back, some people will, you know, have a long discussion about whether or not you should go and visit, whether you should, you shouldn't, these discussions. And I say, well, you know, it was our tribal leaders were the ones who were the first ones to go back over there. So so you have in photographs and in short piece passages about the photographs, you have then this idea about development and progress and what it's meant for Navajo people. You know, and there's some really great photographs in here, you know, as citizens of the United States and as citizens of the Navajo Nation, we participate in this democratic society. So you have photographs of Navajos being signed up to vote. You know, you have a picture of women putting in their vote, their paper into the ballot box. You have pictures of the tribal, the assembly to consider a tribal constitution. I think that was in the 1930s, I think. And one of the things that is interesting about the assembly for tribal, assembling leaders of the tribal, for the tribal constitution to consider it, the Commissioner of Indian Affairs with the Franciscans at St. Michael's Mission, like, you know, Father Berard Hale, they went throughout all of the Navajo communities looking for the natural leaders, you know. And, of course, the natural leaders were all men, you know. And then I was talking to Dr. Ferris here, and he said, yeah, and all the natural leaders were not only men, but they were Catholics, too. You know? And I was like, well, actually, you're right. That is true, because I've been looking at, you know, some of the background of these leaders who came out, you know, for this assembly. Okay. There's a couple of pictures in here that I think really speak about the meaning of progress as it was disseminated about Navajos and to Navajos. There's a photograph in here of a meeting of Raymond Nakai with the vice president, what was his name? Humphrey? Hubert Humphrey, was that his name? Yeah. And so you have the men in Windrock, the head of state, you know, all sitting at the table. And you have women, Navajo women, sitting behind them. And they've got, you know, the 1968 bob, you know, the thing like this. But they're wearing the velvet outfits, you know, and they're standing behind the men. And the women are, the only women sitting at the table are the wives of the powerful men. And the women standing behind them, Navajo women dressed in traditional wear, are the hostesses, you know, who are serving the heads of state. And so at the same time that you have these images of what, you know, a democracy should look like and what a nation looks like, you also have these messages being disseminated through the Navajo paper, the Navajo Times, which was owned by the Navajo tribe at this time. And so you'll see photographs here, you know, telling Navajos this is the proper order of things, these are the proper gender roles. You'll see like an announcement for a male, and it'll say specifically looking for a male supervisor to head this department, this Navajo department, you know, must have this and this and must have at least high school education. Same page up above, you see women, Navajo women, all sitting in a row in front of typewriters. And the caption says, these women are learning to be clerks and they're studying at Fort Lewis College, you know. And so the messages that Navajos are receiving in 1968 is that the proper structure of society is hierarchical and it's patriarchal, and that women's proper places are to serve men, you know, as heads of state and in the domestic sphere. And so I think that's pretty fascinating that you can see this development and what development means, but also this process of agreeing that this is the proper order of the world, you know. And then this is one of my favorite photographs. So I'll pass this around so you guys can see the book. This is at the end, the book. And one of the things that was really important about the language of the language of development in the 1950s and 1960s was the development of Navajo natural resources. You know, that this was just the route to go, and that to be get into the modern world. What was also meant by that was to have our natural resources developed, and that the development of our natural resources would benefit us as Navajo people. And so here's a photograph of the promise of development and the promise of development of our natural resources. And it seems that we have agreed that the ideal family is a nuclear family. You know, never mind that Navajos were at one time polygamous, and that men had, you know, wealthy men had several wives. And so you have here, it seems it's a black and white photograph, but you have you can kind of tell that there's the sun out there, you know, and that, you know, there's a few clouds there, but it just looks like a really bright day. And in the background, you have one of those huge grids, electric grids, which is taking Navajo energy down to Tucson and Los Angeles and Albuquerque and Santa Fe, and you know, bypassing Navajos. And then you have the couple, the Navajo couple, the mother and the father, the babies in the cradle. They probably have, 2.3 children, you know. And you still have the water barrel, and I'm sure this is, you know, they got a barrel in the back of the wagon, and I'm sure it's probably got water in it. And they actually do have 2.3 children. There's a boy and a girl, and the baby in the cradle there, and the husband and the wife, and they're talking to another Navajo man. And you can probably imagine, you know, with this picture, that probably back at their hogan, they have a little, you know, Kentucky grass around their hogan and a little white picket fence, you know. And so that was the promise of what accepting American values meant, you and the development of natural resources. In some of the part of the discourse in this period in 1968, you see also is also the dilemma of tradition versus progress, you know. Just this concern that if we go too far into the modern period and progress, what will happen to our traditional values? How do we bridge this, you know? And so there was those concerns as well as the tradition versus modern, the tradition versus progress rhetoric. It was a dilemma of how do we move forward and yet keep our traditional values with us, you know. And out of that, I think, came this phrase that some of you are probably familiar with, you know, bridging two worlds, living in two worlds, confused because you can't bridge these two worlds, you know. Very much a 60s and 70s language about the polarizing what modern means and what tradition means, you know, and being concerned about not being Navajo enough because you're living in a modern period. So that language and the assumptions about what progress meant and what development meant, I think was really crucial in shaping the contours of the Navajo Nation, you know, and it continues to be very important in the ways in which we perceive ourselves nationally as Navajos. You know, we think that we have something in common with Navajos who live in Crown Point, who live in Tuba City, who live in southern Utah. And how does that sense of commonality come across? You know, how is it disseminated, those messages that we have something common, the creation of a common Navajo past? You know, I think it's an interesting question. So then in some of my work, in the work that I've been doing and some of my work in progress, I look at that space of the political space, the space of nation, because it is a space that is still colonized. It is a space that privileges male power. It positions power as one that is hierarchical. It is one that does not, it's sexist as well, okay? And it's also racist. Okay? And in my work, I have an article that you guys might be interested in. It's slated to be published two more times for two other publications, but it's the one, what's it called? It's called Chairman, Presidents, and Princesses, The Navajo Nation and the Politics of, The Navajo Nation, Gender, and the Politics of Tradition. Okay. And I look at the work of scholars who are using a gender framework to look at how women are positioned within nation, you know, particularly through, for my work, the pageant, the Miss Navajo pageant, you know. You have men who are in positions of power, and you have women being positioned as the role reflects the mother of the nation. Okay? And when you look at the place of the pageant, you know, because they're always saying that the pageant, the Miss Navajo pageant, reflects traditional Navajo women's roles. When you look at it closely, you come to find that the characteristics and the ideals espoused for women are really 19th century Victorian ideals. Okay, you just look at the criteria for women who want to be Miss Navajo, you know, must be a virgin, must never have smoked, must not be living with her boyfriend, must not be chewing tobacco, has to have two escorts wherever she goes, you know. So that she's, on the one hand, she is supposed to model the most revered woman, the most revered deity, changing woman. You know, and the contradiction is that, one of the contradictions is that changing woman is celebrated for her sexuality, you know, for her ability to reproduce the next generation. So I like looking at those kinds of things. Another kind of imposition that comes when we talk about nations, or when we begin to nationalize common ideals and common values, is, and this is also in the same article, my looking at how Radmila Kodi is treated. You know, so in very much the same way that we carve national boundaries and ideas about common values, common American values, we're also doing very much the same thing in carving and recreating Navajo national boundaries. And so when Ms. Radmila Kodi in 1998 was voted to be the best candidate for Ms. Navajo, her mother is Navajo and her father is African American. You know, within a month of her winning the pageant as Miss Navajo, there began to be this discussion on Navajo and objections from people saying that she possibly cannot represent the Navajo people because she has black blood. You know, and so there, then we have emerging and put out there public display Navajo racism and discrimination, you know, against a Navajo who has black blood. You know, so I thought that was a pretty interesting conversation that we had. Radmila has come to be a really good friend of mine. I admire her for her courage, you know, in standing up and talking openly about being Navajo and being African American. And a couple of days, maybe last month, I was talking to some other Navajos, and they said one of the things that Radmila has done in being vocal about it and bringing public awareness to being biracial is that she has made it acceptable for relationships with other Navajos who are Navajo and African American. She says, before, we wouldn't have seen a Navajo marrying a Navajo who was Navajo and African American. She says she has made it acceptable. You know, so I thought that was pretty cool. So then another thing that I'm working on right now, post 9/11, you know, the Navajo cultural landscape in the wake of September 11th became militarized, was already militarized, but we responded in very much the same way that other Americans did to what was going on post 9/11. And so I really began to think about a history of Navajo participation in U.S. wars, and think about how Navajos have aligned a traditional warrior tradition to align it with soldiering for the United States. You know, people talk about it as being part of a cultural tradition, that this is a warrior tradition. And I have a really difficult time with soldiering for the United States and not understanding or trying to bring awareness to Navajo Native peoples that what American imperialism is doing in the Middle East was the same policies that were applied to the Native peoples. You know, that Manifest Destiny is alive and well, and that what we went through as Navajo people, the dispossession, the devastation, the catastrophe, that's what's happening in Iraq, you know, and how can we as Navajo people be complicit in that immoral war? And so we talk about this, and it's a really difficult topic to talk to about Navajo people, because that way of thinking is so strongly entrenched in our society, you know. But I get some pretty good thoughtful discussions when I do talk about it. Saturday, I think it was, I'm teaching a course right now for Navajo grad students who, when they grow up, they're going to be school administrators. They want to be principals when they grow up. And so I'm giving them a class on Navajo governance and leadership. And I brought in Marie Salt, who is a cultural resource specialist and a medicine woman. Her husband's a medicine man from Kienta, Arizona. And she was talking about concepts of warrior, what it means to be warrior. And she said, all of us have a male and a female side. And she said, one side of us is female and one side of us is male. One side of us is the protector and one side of us is the nurturer, and that we all have that in us. And I think one of the things that's also was nice about what she had to talk about was that she said that there's a space, there's a place for Navajo women to be leaders. You know, because, you know, we had the third Navajo woman run just this last election against the now president, Joe Shirley. Linda Lovejoy ran. And you should have heard the discussions in Navajo land, you know, all these, even young women saying, you know, oh, my God, if a woman is elected to the highest position in Navajo land, you know, it's going to be the end of the world. Chaos will ensue, you know, and this is, you know, based on tradition, you know. Never mind that the tribal government is not traditional, you know. They don't want to talk about that. They just want to talk about how the world will just go to hell when a woman becomes president of the Navajo Nation, you know. So she had some really good positive things to say about women in leadership roles, and I really appreciated her telling us that. And so thinking about the concepts of warriorship, traditional concepts of warriorship, and how we have applied them to soldiering for the United States, I think is something that deserves a lot of critical thought, reflection, and interrogation, and especially by my own people and by other Native people, you know. What does it mean to be a warrior? I think that there's a book called Big Horse the Warrior by Tiana Big Horse. It's one of my favorite books. It's an English version of an oral history, a Navajo oral history. And Tiana, she just passed away, I don't know, 1996, I think it was, as a grandmother. But she learned the stories. She heard the stories her father, Gus Big Horse, told. And these are warrior stories. They're supposed to be reserved for men. But the young men were not listening. She was the only one who was listening to those warrior stories. So her father allowed her to hear the stories and to pass them on. And she wanted to pass it on to a larger audience of people, including Navajo people. And one of the things that she says in there about being a warrior, being a Navajo warrior, is that a warrior is the last one who is standing. You know, a warrior is one who is keeping the fire going, who is ministering to the sick, who is compassionate, you know, and sympathetic and takes care of the people. She says that's what a warrior means. And one of the other things that Marie Salt said yesterday, which I think the students took inspiration, was she says that when you're a leader, when you're a warrior and a leader, she says you stand there in the face of danger. She says it's scary and it's a huge responsibility. She says, but you look the enemy in the eye. She says, and they were like, yep. So that, I think, is important in terms of taking apart what we mean by warrior. As part of this fellowship that I took from the Office of the State Historian, I went and looked at papers over at the Southwest Research in the Zimmerman Library, and I was looking through John Redhouse's papers. You know, I kind of heard about John Redhouse. He has this really great article that he self-published called The Geopolitics of the Navajo-Hopi Land Dispute. And I think that John Redhouse has the same vision that our ancestors who fought against Mexican and then American invasion of our lands and who really was dedicated to the sovereignty, who is dedicated to the sovereignty of his people. I think that he is a true warrior, you know. And so John Redhouse used to write columns for the Navajo Times under the McDonald administration. And the last column that he wrote for the Navajo Times, Navajos settled their land claims in 1986. We lost almost all, I think we lost all of northern Arizona. They said that the land claims court decided that we had not been around in the Southwest long enough to have established Aboriginal ties to northern Arizona. And so we therefore had no claims to Arizona. And then for the lands that we had aboriginally that we lost, they then compensated us with 1848 land prices. You know, it's a wonder that I'm just pissed all the time. So, John Redhouse, in his last column for the Navajo Times, says that and berates the tribal council for accepting the price given to us for lost lands. And that was his last column. McDonald ordered the Navajo Times to not publish his work anymore. But if you want to read his columns, his papers are over at the Southwest Research Center, and I think it's some incredible stuff. Looking at in terms of nation and how we think of ourselves as a nation and how our values, Navajo values, which are considered to be traditional, are actually reflection of American values, you know, I think is a really crucial question. Part of that work I'm doing on the militarization of Navajo country also has to do with, you know, after 9/11, the same thing, I'm fascinated with how the same kind of thing happened after the arms race, the Cold War, you know, and in the Cold War atmosphere, how people were scared and they were, you know, they didn't know where the fear, you know, where the insecurity, and there was a threat coming from somewhere and we didn't know where it was coming from, but we trusted our government to take care of us. And in the process of letting them take care of us, they built this incredible nuclear arsenal. You know, we have the most warheads in the world. You know, I don't know what the hell we're scared of. You know, you see those bumper stickers that say there are more warheads in Albuquerque than there are in Iraq, you know. So, in that era, then you had this call for a return to traditional family values. No. And that means, you know, nuclear family, gender being feminine and masculine, and, you know, that sort of thing. So I see the same thing happening post 9/11, and I see the same thing happening in Navajo country, you know, responding to that fear. You know, when they call, you know, they do the security code and say, you know, today it's red or today it's blue, and, you know, go out and buy water and duct tape. You know, I don't know what Navajo family are going to do with duct tape. You know, put it on their Hogan windows. I have no idea, but I'm sure they went out to Walmart and bought their water and their duct tape. Okay. So in that atmosphere of insecurity and fear, and you don't know where, you know, you don't know who to trust and you don't know what's going to happen, the return to family values, the question of same-sex marriage ban, you know, the place of transgender, gays and lesbians in our society in the face of these conservative American values, same discussion happening in Indian country, you know. Out of nowhere, you know, the council delegate Larry Anderson writes legislation, Navajo version of the same-sex marriage ban, and you're just like, why? You know, what does this have to do with anything? So then you have another discussion among Navajo people about Nutle, which is the Navajo word for hermaphrodite, you know, and about gays and lesbians and marriage, you know, and then Larry Anderson espousing that Navajos believe in traditional marriage, that marriage is between a man and a woman, but he didn't say a man and several women, you know. Which was traditional, you know, probably up to the 1950s. And so one of the panels that that the Dene Policy Institute, we had a discussion about the same-sex marriage ban. We had a discussion about family and sexuality with all these people. It was a really amazing day, you know, to sit there and listen to people and just this outright discrimination and hatred of difference that we have learned, you know, because the anthropologist W.W. Hill, I don't know what W.W. stands for, Hill, his observations in the 1930s, he was already seeing transformations in the way in which Navajos were responding to third and multiple genders. You know, he records this incident where he said there was a Nutley man dressed as a woman, and some schoolboys scoffing and making fun of him, whereupon the Nutley went home and he changed back into menswear. You know, so by the 1930s, he was already seeing this shift in how we are no longer accepting of third and multiple genders in Navajo society. I think that traditionally we recognized more than two genders, and I think that national values, Navajo national values, which are imposed upon us from Western concepts of values, I think has really transformed the way in which we think about gender, you know, and sexuality and those things. So that's part of my the work that I'm doing. And I do have to say that when I sat in on that Policy Institute, it was really amazing to see how traditional values look just very, very much like conservative Republican values. You know, it's really amazing to me. You know, so the first thing, people are really careful at the panel. They're not, you know, they're careful about what to say first. And so there was this woman who is a cultural specialist, Navajo cultural specialist. She starts by saying, well, we don't have one of those in our family, you know. And then I spoke next and said that I was not going to tolerate discrimination and hatred towards my own people from my own people, you know. And so then the rest of the conversation then was, they were very careful. And you could see them searching for just the right sentence, you know. And when this topic emerged, students at Diné College formed a gay-straight alliance, and a traditional scholar, Harry Walters, agreed to be their faculty sponsor. And so at the end of the panel discussion, Harry Walters said, I have one of those in my family, you know. So I just wanted to give you an idea of just the kind of work that I'm doing and looking at in terms of nation as still colonized spaces, and that we as Navajo people have to be critical, and we have to interrogate these spaces in order for us to rebuild our society, our community, and our nation on Navajo traditional values, you know. I am very respectful of our own values. I think that they are worthy. And one of the things that I tell my students also is that we must have a vision, and we have to think far into the future for our children and for our grandchildren, for our great-great-grandchildren. You know, we have to lay the groundwork for them. And so language is very powerful. It can move mountains. And so when we hear this, maybe we will start to change the way we think. And scholarship is about transformation. You know, it's about critical consciousness, and it's about making change. So that's what it means to me. So thank you very much. There's a whole lot of definitions of sovereignty. I think that for Navajo people to fully realize their sovereignty, we have to take control of our land and our resources, our communities. We still have all of that to do. It's a tremendous, tremendous undertaking, you know. And one of the things that I've been looking at is this concept of cultural sovereignty. You know, the ways in which we continue to value and disseminate traditional values at an individual level and as strategies at the community. You know, I'm really good at talking about the problems and whining about the problems and saying this doesn't work, and criticizing. Finding models that work, strategies that work for transformation is something that I'm working on. So I just think it's really, I see a lot of people exercising cultural sovereignty, the right. Eloise Brown, who is the president of Doda Desert Rock, I think is someone who has a very the same vision that our ancestors had, you know, to keep the land for the future generations. I think she's someone who does that. The young people who are working on Save the Peaks in Flagstaff, they're just young Navajo people, you know. They've done tremendous work. They've managed to bring all 13 tribes in Arizona together to stand against businesses in Flagstaff who want to create wastewater to make snow on the peaks. You know, just people, you know. A couple from the Capitans from Crown Point, they begin the resistance against uranium mining in Crown Point. You know, the struggle never ends. It doesn't end. And now we're in another wave because then they're looking to mine more uranium. You know, sometimes it's really, you despair because it just seems like the struggle never ends. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Most countries in the world, the way they control land is through a standing military. They have passports and mm-hmm. issue their own currency and stamps. Do you ever see the Navajo Nation as wanting to do that sometime to be a sovereign nation, or is that just not an issue for the Navajo Nation?
I think it's an issue. I think that, I mean, we have the branches. We have a legislative, we have a judicial, we have, I don't know what the other ones are called right off the top of my head. Executive, yeah. I mean, they're a functioning government, you know. But at least 50 percent of the budget comes from the federal government. We just gave away our water rights. So, if you think about, you know, that the place of education in just making benign the ongoing processes of colonialism, and that unless we change the education of our children and bring in critical consciousness and doing it ourselves, shouldering our responsibility, only then can we begin to see change. But, you know, tribes are sovereign nations. The fact that not one single treaty the United States ever signed with Native Nations doesn't make them null and void. You know, it just says that the United States is immoral and that it doesn't keep its agreements. You know, that's what it says. So.
What were the reasons that some people gave for casinos that
you were talking about earlier? The medicine people were reiterating the stories of how gambling came into Navajo society, and it has to do with the gambler being at Chaco Canyon, taking over Chaco Canyon, and the stories being about corruption and greed, and that if we allow it, then we will go the same way that the people at Chaco went, is the warning from the stories. But their sense seemed to be that there's always been gambling, you know, and so we're just having gambling again, seemed to be what they were saying.
When I talked to the first grade up at Monument Valley, because of the prohibition on sacred music, one of the things that our little kids sang was a gambling song.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they had a shoe or a moccasin, and they would pass it back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
I forget what the name is.
The shoe game? Yeah.
No, I mean, I forget what the Navajo name was for the song, but uh-huh. I used to almost be able to sing it, but I mean, mm-hmm. we just did it all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes?
Casino they open has been apparently fabulously successful. I was wondering, how are they using those revenues? Do you anticipate they'll be building a big Las Vegas style casino like the bubble tribes down here have done?
The casino is we're stealing from our own people. There was a cartoon in the last one of the last two Navajo times where the Navajo grandma and grandpas are coming out of the casino and they said, well, we lost all of our money. We're going to have to go get commodity foods and something else. That's my phone, sorry. And then on the other side, the tribal council is saying, oh, where shall we hold our next meeting? You know, because the money's coming out. When we were on that panel at the Net Policy Institute, one of the tribal council members from Apache came. His wife is Navajo, and he came and sat in. And he was telling us about their casino at White River. And he says, these are all the ills that will be rained upon you. And he's becoming right. You're seeing it happening right there. Navajo's voted it down twice, and it hasn't deterred them. You know, from they're talking about another casino in Halk, and another casino at Page. So, and the revenues are kept secret. We don't know what they do with them. I have no idea. So, you had a question, Valerie, in the back? Yeah.
Yes.
I haven't seen anything about it, and that was to sell the produce from Napi to Cuba, and I just haven't seen anything else about it. So,
yeah. Is the National Park Service going to turn Canyon de Chelly over to the Navajo Nation?
You know, I don't understand these Navajos. I don't understand that. This is traditional Navajo land. This is a sacred place. This was the fortress, the defense place of Navajo people. And then the National Park Service took it over. And one of the council delegates has submitted a resolution to get back under Navajo jurisdiction the ownership of Canyon de Chelly. And these Navajos that live there say, no, we don't want to come under Navajo. You know, we're treated better by National Park Service. And it's there's this huge sense of, we've been taught for five generations that we don't know how to do anything ourselves. You know, just this incredible paternalistic attitude towards us that continues, that we've learned to believe that we don't know how to do anything ourselves and that we're going to fall and everything's going to go to hell, you know. And I just don't get it.
Symbol for sovereignty.
You would think, yeah, you would think. No, I think that, you know, it's our homeland, and we should claim it. You know? So those are the kinds of that's part of the discussions that are happening in Navajo land. Yes. Yes.
I had a couple of things coming from some of our Pueblo friends.
Mm-hmm.
One is a Tewa woman in Tasuke who said it was only in her grandfather's generation that women were put under the thumb of the men, that prior to her grandfather's generation, everybody knew women were the leaders and women were in charge.
Mm-hmm.
And she attributes it to American paternalism.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was interesting, that it's within her memory that
mm-hmm.
this has all changed,
mm-hmm.
and that they need to get back to women and wisdom, the wisdom
mm-hmm.
of women. And the second one was from a Caris man from Santo Domingo who said that when they were looking for volunteers for the Second World War, that an elder wearing a traditional skin and hat like you described said that he was a warrior and therefore they should join, but not to join because of America, but to join in defense of their own homeland.
Mm-hmm.
They were not helping America in that war. They were defending their own homeland. And I thought that was interesting because oftentimes we look at patriotism and it's always to America. It's always to Uncle Sam. It's always to the flag. But in his concept, it was the men that joined because they were defending their homeland. They were warriors for their own families, their own children and their own wives and their own elders. It was really had less to do with America than it did with their own homeland defense. And I thought that was an interesting point of view.
I think that we don't recognize the generations of colonialism and that we take something as traditional and it's really not traditional. I don't think it's traditional to be soldiering for the United States. And that's part of, you know, that's the rationale that I've heard before. But when I was working on the patriotism piece, the militarization piece, I kept thinking, where did this come from? Where did this brainwashing come from? And it was looking like some really huge, you know, mind-blowing, idea from somewhere. It's really very simple. It's the boarding schools. I'm like, of course, I'm looking for something way out there, and it's right there in front of my face. And then I'm looking at policies, legislation, and there's a Patriotism Act, Patriot Act. I can't remember what year it was put out there for Indian people. But, we grew up in institution, military institution-like schools, Of course. It's just so, obvious, So... Yeah. You had a question? Yeah.
Not just comments. You've hit on a number of things. I'm from Towson, okay, Wingate, that mm-hmm. I really agree with.
Uh-huh.
But I did my student teaching at Fort Wingate, and mm-hmm. I remember that the movies that the students were watching in their free time were mm-hmm. Calvary and Indian mm-hmm. movies.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just one federal organization fitting off another one, the mm-hmm. Army and the boarding school, the Army.
Mm-hmm.
Was there
mm-hmm.
any idea that any of these students were going to go have an option
mm-hmm.
to college
yeah.
or to do anything else?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was just never unquestioning. And it's all, and to some way, it's sort of like that.
Yeah.
But, you see a lot of our veterans are just damaged.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like the rest of the veterans,
mm-hmm.
from Vietnam and all that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If they had known there was something else besides that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If they had known there was something else besides that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, the recent Navajo textbook that was approved by the state?
Yeah. Evangeline Parsons Yazzie?
Yeah, that was how are you going to decolonize the Christian fundamentalists who objected to that work?
Mm-hmm.
Because she said that, all Navajo concepts are in the language, so maybe it's going to be a self-defeating thing, but for a group of Native people to object to a Navajo textbook?
Well, the even weirder thing is that Evangeline Parsons Yazzie is a fundamental Christian. One of the other things that I'm working at in terms of militarization is just how integral to war rape and violence is, the rape of women, is that's just so key to war. And that's what I'm also looking at as well. And when you tell Navajo, first let me say that when I present to Navajo people and I tell them about these ideas about colonization and that we're colonized, and they're like, yeah, of course. So I'm not telling them anything that they don't know. One of the things about it is that we know this. It's our experiences. But in a lot of cases, people just haven't named it. Indian history, Navajo history is, in the face of catastrophe, they showed agency and resiliency, 97% of our people didn't show agency and resiliency. We're less than 1% of the population, The rest of us just didn't have it, the agency and the resiliency. So, moving away from that framework, which is still very much in place, and just really makes benign the historical experiences of Native peoples. And one of the things that's happening, that's changing, I think it's really wonderful, is the willingness for people to contemplate that there was a Native Holocaust, that there is genocide, that there is ethnocide, but it's a long time coming, and it's slow in terms of moving into the language of scholarship. Canada is way far ahead of us in terms of recognizing, I'm not saying they're the best at it, but there has been some change in Canada in terms of recognizing genocide of Native peoples and the Holocaust, that happened, and particularly the abuses that happened through residential schools. One of the panels that I went to with Te Aki Alfred and Wazi Watangwan at this conference was saying no to reconciliation, Don't apologize and then pretend like it's all going to be over, because it's not over. And when you give back the land, maybe we can talk about reconciliation, So anything else? Yeah, one more.
You're the first Indian that I have heard since Buffy St. Marie that sort of shared a view that I have
mm-hmm.
of the situation of the warrior versus the soldier.
Mm-hmm.
And it's nice to hear. I argued with the former chief of the Comanches, Ron Burgess, about that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you were mentioning maybe in the lore, in the traditional lore about the protector. Well, what you would have, you know, the half of all of us is the protector. However, what I see all the time in the media is, you know, thank a vet for your freedom because freedom is not free. And you always have defense. It's always the defense. They have saved America. Since World War II, Korea, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Panama, Grenada, Haiti, Iraq, I have never seen anybody that's been coming over to attack me that I needed to defend myself against any of those people. And in all those wars, you've had Indian people. And I heard on the, what do they call it, the talking wire, the station, the, and some people call in and they say, yeah, our warrior tradition. I heard from the people that were in, what do they call it, not science fiction, but connected to it, the fantasy genre of literature. One of the women was explaining, she said, well, you know, a warrior is not a soldier. Now you have guys that are in Nevada that are manning these drones, and they go home and they bomb up people in Afghanistan every day, and they go home with their kids in the afternoon. Well, if you have an Indian that's doing that, how can he be a warrior? You're talking about seeing them in the eye. In the old day, a warrior was hand-to-hand fighting. Nowadays, you blow up people and you don't even see them. You don't know them or anything.
There was something I was going to say, and I can't remember what it was. Yeah?
I just want to make one comment. I'm a Vietnam veteran. When you look at wars, obviously, summary takes place in all wars, and there are some wars where it is widespread. For the most part, it doesn't take place, you know.
I just don't believe that at all. Well, I mean, once you, I think that it's very invisible, and that once you begin to look at the accounts and you begin to research it, that you actually find that rape and violence towards women is just integral to war. It's just so a crucial part of war, but we don't even know about it, you know, because we don't pay attention to it.
Obama doesn't want to show those pictures, and he said we want to go forward. Program and said most of those pictures are all about rapes. Rapes of women, rapes of little boys, rapes by men, people sitting there watching them, having a good time watching them, raping them, raping them with batons, and so on.
There was one photo of a woman, one of a man. I can assure you, being in a war situation, your primary objective is to stay alive and accomplish your military mission, and rape is just not part of it. I mean, you can't do it. It's too dangerous.
In the hearings that what's the guy that ran for president and he was in Vietnam and got shot three times?
McCain.
Kerry. In those, they had a film here in Santa Fe, and one of the guys that was in that hearing was there. They did not even show Kerry, and I have always seen the film clips of Kerry talking to Congress. What do they call it?
Winter soldier?
The man, when the senators were asking him, and they went on and they said, well, this and this. And the guys were just laughing all the time, the Vietnam vets.
I've seen that documentary.
Lieutenant Calley, he said, every village we went in, we raped. Every single village. Mm-hmm. That's before Congress.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you all.